to copy documents. I went back to my car and sat in the parking lot, leafing through my little pile of treasures. I started with the information related to Tom Paget. There was an affidavit, death of joint tenant, in which Cora's name was removed from the deed to the house. Over the next several years, Tom Paget had bought numerous properties on money borrowed from a Santa Maria bank, but most had been paid off according to the full reconveyances on file. I gave a cursory look at the grant deeds in the names of Calvin and Rachel Wilcox, all of which seemed unremarkable, and then moved on to Jake Ottweiler. He and B.W. McPhee had purchased the property on which the Blue Moon was situated on December 12, 1953, for the sum of $22,000, a figure I calculated from the line of tax stamps pasted along the left margin. I remembered B.W. mentioning the couple thousand dollars he'd thrown into the pot, which meant that Jake had come up with roughly $20,000. There had to have been a hefty additional sum to cover the liquor license, expansion, and remodeling they'd done. I sat and thought about what I'd found, then started the car and backed out of the slot. Time to hit the road. Chapter 29. As soon as I reached Santa Maria, I pulled into a gas station and filled my tank, then parked to one side of the service bay and used the payphone. I put a call through to the hospital where Daisy worked and asked for the medical records department. Once she was on the line, I told her I was back in town. "Is there any way I can park myself at your place? I've got notes to type and some calls I want to make." "Sure, no problem. There's a house key hidden under the flower pot sitting on the porch." "That's not such a keen idea, Daisy. Everyone hides the key under a flower pot. Burglars know that, and it's the first place they look." "Well, goody. I'm happy to hear. Frustrate a burglar, and the next thing you know, he's busting your windows or gouging at the locks. Oh, and as long as you're there, would you mind switching the clothes out of the washer and into the dryer? You just ran a load, is that all you do?" "Hey, it's a harmless vice," she replied. At Daisy's, I let myself in and then did as she'd asked, after which I set my typewriter on the dining room table and assembled my notes. I picked my way through my index cards, looking for loose ends. I knew I'd missed something, but it wasn't immediately obvious going over my notes. Or possibly it was so obvious I couldn't catch sight of it. In the process of collating the bits and pieces, I came across Ty Edding's name. He'd been at the Tanner property with Liza on Friday night, and while she remembered nothing of the car that had pulled up in front, he might make a better witness. I put a call through to Liza. "Hey, this is Kinsey. I'm sitting here squinting at my notes and thinking it might be helpful if I could talk to Ty Eddings." "Why?" "To ask about the guy you spotted at the Tanner property that night. You have any idea where Ty is at this point?" "No." I waited and then tried a prompt. "Not even a guess?" "I told you I never heard from him again, so how would I know? Dead or in jail for all I care." "What about his aunt? What was her name?" "York. Dahlia. She left town when her husband died, and I don't know where she went." "What about kids?" "Someone told me Ty had a cousin named Kyle. Is York his last name?" "Yes." "Liza, why are you making this so difficult? Are you mad at me?" There was a silence. Finally, frostily, "Not to chide you for your lack of sensitivity, Kinsey, but did it occur to you I might be upset about Violet's death? You treat it like ho-hum, oh well, one down and on to the next." I could feel myself wince. "I'm sorry. I didn't think about that. You're right, and I apologize. I get focused on what I'm doing, and I forget about the emotional end of things." Silence. "You want to talk about it?" I asked. The question felt lame in the wake of her criticism. If you have to be told how to behave, it doesn't count. "Not particularly. I'd like time to grieve in private, if it's all right with you." "Of course. I didn't mean to intrude. Look, I'm hanging out at Daisy's. Why don't you call me later if you feel like conversation?" Silence. I could hear her breathing. Finally, she said, Kyle York lives in San Luis Obispo. He's an allergist. She hung up abruptly, leaving me to deliver my penitent thank you to dead air. I tried directory assistance, asking for a listing for Kyle York, M.D. I expected an office number, but surprisingly, the operator offered me a choice.
You want the office or his home?
I might as well take both. She gave me the numbers, which I jotted on a card. I knew if I called the office, I'd either be left on terminal hold, listening to shitty music, or some officious receptionist would quiz me at length about my need to speak to him. I was thinking I'd wait until the end of the day and try his home phone, but on impulse, I dialed. After 5 rings, a woman picked up. I said, Mrs. York?
Well, yes, but you're probably looking for my daughter-in-law, and she's not here right now. She's taken the dog to the grooming shop and won't be back for an hour and a half. May I tell her who called?
Her voice sounded slightly wobbly, as though from disuse. Are you Dr. York's mother?
Yes, I am. May I help you with something?
She sounded pleased that I knew of her existence. I wasn't sure that she'd be quite so pleased when I told her my purpose. I had one split second to decide how to play the conversation. The truth didn't have a chance. I'm actually an old friend of Kyle's from elementary school. We lost touch years ago, but someone said he had a practice in San Luis Obispo, so I thought I'd give him a call.
That's very sweet of you. What did you say your name was?
Tanny Ottweiler.
You must be Jake Ottweiler's girl.
Yes, ma'am, I am.
How's your father?
He's fine. He sends his regards.
Oh, he always was the sweetest man. I haven't seen him now for 16 or 17 years. I didn't leave Serena Station until a couple of years ago when I moved in with Kyle and his wife, she said, warming to the subject.
She went on for a bit, clearly lonely and desperate for human contact. Of course, I felt like a heel, but I never set her straight. It's not nice to lie to old ladies. Even I know that much. We exchanged reminiscences, hers real, mine invented. Then I slithered my way over to the point. Whatever happened to that cousin of his, the one from Bakersfield?
You mean Ty?
Exactly. As I remember, he went back to Bakersfield on the spur of the moment, and that's the last I heard. How's he doing these days?
Fine.
Do you have a number for him?
Well, dear, he's in Sacramento, but I don't understand why you'd want to talk to him when you called to speak to Kyle.
I thought I might as well round up the whole gang while I was at it, I said. I was trying to sound casual and jolly, but I couldn't pull it off. I could feel the chill through the line. The lady might be old, but her intuitions were alive and well.
You're Liza Mellencamp, aren't you?
Actually, I'm not. This was the only moment in the conversation when I told her the truth, and I was hoping to get credit.
Well, whoever you are, I've already told you as much as I deem wise. Thank you for calling, but don't call again.
She hung up with perhaps more force than I thought appropriate in a woman her age. I hung up on my end and then took a quick break. Sometimes lying is sweaty work and leaves me feeling short of breath. I hadn't expected to be put on the carpet like that. I went and folded some of Daisy's clothes just to give my brain a rest. I returned to the phone and called directory assistance in Sacramento and asked for a number for last name Eddings, first name, initial T, Ty, or Tyler. This time my only option was his office number. As it turned out, Ty Eddings was an attorney in a law firm with a string of names that went on with all the lilt and cadence of a nursery rhyme. The receptionist connected me with his secretary, who told me Mr. Eddings was in court. I gave her my name and Daisy's number, asking her to have him return the call.
May I ask what this is in regard to?
A death.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes, I said. By the way, what kind of law does he practice?
Criminal.
In that case, tell him it's about a murder, and I need to hear from him as soon as possible. I spent the next hour typing up my notes. This was my last day on the job, and I wanted to leave Daisy with an organized account of what I'd done. I wasn't entirely satisfied with myself. There were too many loose ends, and the legwork itself didn't add up to much. On the other hand, she'd now found her mother, which was what she'd wanted to begin with. Among the many unanswered questions, one issue that troubled me was the lace curtain. Foley had torn down the first panel in the course of the fight he and Violet had Thursday night, the 2nd of July. An infuriated Violet had torn down the rest, and she'd thrown them in the trash. Foley claimed great remorse, so much so that he'd gone out and bought her the Bel Air the very next day. If he'd killed her and buried her in the car, why wrap the body in the curtain? If the body was ever found, which of course it was, why leave behind an item that would link the deed to him? Foley might be cursed with a limited imagination, but he wasn't that dumb. Having typed my way through to the end of my notes, I stacked the pages of my report and tucked them into a folder. I went back and read the various sections of the newspapers I'd photocopied, both before and after Violet's disappearance. When I reached the item about Livia Kramer's home demonstration party, I realized that Mrs. York, who'd been awarded one of the prizes, was, in fact, the same Mrs. York I'd spoken to less than an hour before. This is the amusing thing about information. Facts exist within a framework. Data that might seem meaningless in one context can later serve as a little window on reality. I was cruising through the remainder of the newspapers when I stumbled on an item I hadn't seen before. On July 6th, in the second section, there was a small item about a man named Philemon Sullivan, age 27, who was arrested for drunk and disorderly conduct. The fine was $150, and he was given a suspended sentence of 125 days in the county jail. Was that Foley? The age was right, and I knew from the names in the city directory that he and Violet were the only Sullivans in town. I checked the date again. July 6th. The article didn't specify when the fellow had been picked up, but Foley swore he'd never had another drink after Violet vanished. Until the other night, of course, but who cared about that? I pulled out the phone book and looked up the number for the Presbyterian church where Foley was employed. I picked up the handset and then found myself hesitating. I didn't want to have to drive to Cromwell, but it didn't seem smart to question him by phone. Better to be present so I could see his reaction. There's sometimes much to be learned from observing body language and facial expressions. Aside from that, I was hoping Ty Eddings would call, and if I tied up the line, he wouldn't be able to get through. I made sure the message machine was on, shoved the file in my bag, then grabbed my car keys and headed out the door. I found Foley in the sunny church kitchen, using an oversized polisher to buff the mottled beige and white vinyl floor tiles. He moved with the awkwardness of a man in pain. He was a mess. His facial swelling had diminished some, but that didn't improve his looks. The adhesive tape was peeling from the splint on his nose. His eye sockets were deep lavender, as though he'd used eye shadow to intensify the blue of his eyes. The bruising had migrated down his cheeks, the pull of gravity creating a beard of subcutaneous blood that darkened the lower portion of his face. Black sutures sprung from his still puffy lips like the whiskers on a catfish. When he realized I was in the room, he shut down his machine and sank gratefully onto a kitchen stool. I pulled out a second stool and perched. "Shouldn't you be in bed?" "I don't like being idle. It's better if I work so I can earn my keep. What brings you this way?" "I've been thinking about the lace curtain the body was wrapped in." He dropped his gaze to his hands. "I wish I hadn't torn those curtains down. That's what drove her away. I know there's no changing what is, but if she hadn't left when she did, she might still be alive." "That's not where I was heading, Foley. I didn't drive all the way out here to make you feel bad," I said. "When did your trash usually get picked up?" He had to stop and think. "Fridays." "But it couldn't have been picked up that Friday because of the holiday, right?" He shrugged. "I'll take your word for it. It was too many years ago." "Well, think about it. The banks were closed. No mail delivery, no government offices open, and no city services, except maybe the bus line, if Serena Station had a bus back then. That sounds right. Which means the curtains were sitting in the trash for 2 full days, all day Friday and all day Saturday, before they landed in that car. The Bel Air wasn't buried until after 9:30 that night. He gave me a startled look, but I headed him off. Just bear with me here. Where did you keep the trash cans?
Alley, behind the house.
So somebody could have stolen the curtains without being seen.
Stolen them? What for?
Because the guy already knew he was going to kill her and bury her in that hole. The curtain-ripping fight was common knowledge. Violet told the story all over town, so on the off chance someone stumbled across the car, his wrapping her in the curtain would point a finger at you. I could sense the wheels laboring in Foley's head. I pushed on. Who's Philemon Sullivan? Is that you?
My mother laid that on me, but I always hated the name, so I called myself Foley.
Weren't you picked up for drunk and disorderly conduct right around that time?
Who told you that?
I saw an item in the paper about a suspended sentence and a $150 fine. This was on July 6th, but there was no mention of the date the arrest was made. When did that happen?
I don't want to talk about it now. It was a long time ago.
34 years, to be exact. So what difference would it make if you tattled on yourself? He was silent for a moment, and then conceded the point.
I was arrested late Friday afternoon and spent the night in jail. I got drunk at the Moon, and I guess I was out of line. BW phoned the sheriff's department, and they came and arrested me. Once I was booked, I called Violet, but she wouldn't come get me. Said it served me right, and I could sit there and rot for all she cared. I was so hungover, I thought I'd die. They finally let me out the next morning.
On Saturday, the 4th? He nodded again. Did anyone see you?
Sergeant Schaefer left the station the same time I did, and he offered me a ride home. Tom Paget would verify that as well, because we picked him up along the way. His truck battery was dead, and he was on his way home to pick up some jumper cables.
You told me you had a job of work, as you put it, early Saturday afternoon. Do you remember what it was?
Yes, ma'am. Sergeant Schaefer asked if I'd help him put together a workbench he was building in his shed. I'm good at carpentry, maybe not finish work, but the kind of thing he needed. He already had the lumber, and we knocked together a workbench for his power tools.
When's your birthday?
August 4th.
Well, here's a belated birthday present. You're off the hook for Violet's murder. Somebody dug that hole between Thursday night and Saturday afternoon. But it couldn't have been you. Thursday night you were home with Violet, tearing up the house. Later, the two of you went over to the Moon and got drunk. Somebody saw a guy operating a bulldozer out on the Tanner property Friday night. But you were in jail by then. So between your jail time and your work for Sergeant Schaefer Saturday afternoon, your whereabouts are accounted for. He stared at me.
Well, I'll be damned.
I wouldn't celebrate quite yet. You'd be smart to go ahead and hire an attorney to protect your backside. In the meantime, I'll be happy to tell Daisy about this. On the way back through Santa Maria, I stopped in at Steve Ottweiler's auto repair shop. The whole business about Harold Tanner's will was bugging me, and I didn't want to ask Jake. Steve showed me into his office, assuming I was there on automotive business. I waited until the chit-chat subsided. Can I ask you something?
Go right ahead.
Tanny told me Harold Tanner died a month after your mom.
In a manner of speaking.
Meaning what?
He shot himself.
Suicide?
That's right. He was a bitter and disillusioned old man. My grandmother was gone, my mom had just died, and he had nothing to live for, in his mind at any rate.
He left a note?
Yes, I still have it, if you doubt my word.
Did he give any explanation about the disposition of his estate?
What's this about?
I'm wondering why Harold Tanner was so angry with your dad. He snorted, as though amused, but his eyes went dead.
What makes you think he was mad?
I saw the will. Oh? And how'd you manage that?
I went down to the courthouse and looked it up. I checked a couple of other wills at the same time, so don't get the idea that I was picking on your dad. Your grandfather set it up so Jake couldn't touch a nickel, not even for the two of you.
I don't see the relevance.
This is my last day on the job. I leave it to the cops to figure out who killed Violet, but I hate to sign off without knowing why she died.
Aren't those two questions the same thing?
I'm not sure.
It's obvious you have a theory, or you wouldn't be here.
I think she was killed for the stash she'd put together so she could run away.
What's that have to do with my father?
I've been wondering where he got the money to buy the Blue Moon.
You're implying...
What? That he killed her for the cash? All I'm asking is how he financed the purchase of the bar.
If you want an answer to that question, you better go over to the Moon and ask him. In the meantime, I'm not going to sit here and put up with your half-assed interrogation on a subject you know nothing about.
Why don't you answer the question and save me the trip?
To make your life easy?
To avoid a subject he might find embarrassing. I think you know more than you've told me so far.
I knew he was angry, but I could see him wrestling with himself. If it's any of your fucking business... My mother had a life insurance policy. Dad collected $60,000, put half in savings accounts for Tanny and me, and used the rest to buy the Moon. The subject is closed, and I want you out of here before I call the police.
He got up from his desk, and with his hand on my elbow, escorted me unceremoniously from the premises. By the time I got back to Daisy's at 4 o'clock, I was ready to pack it in. Clearly, I'd reached the stage in the investigation where people were not only getting pissed off, but resorting to rudeness, sarcasm, and manhandling. Steve Ottweiler had been as aware as I was that there was no way to verify his claim about his mother's life insurance. Jake was never going to tell me which insurance company it was, and after 34 years, I couldn't think how to get the information independently of him. I probably should have gone straight over to Jake's and pressed him on the point. But, in truth, I was ever so faintly intimidated by the man. After I left Steve's office, he had plenty of time to call his dad and tell him what was going on. All Jake had to do was repeat the story Steve had told me, and I'd be none the wiser. I sat down and typed the additional 3 conversations into my report. Mrs. York, Foley, and Steve Ottweiler. This was strictly make-work. By now, it was not so much about being conscientious as it was about giving myself time to think. While my fingers traveled across the keys, my brain was busy with something else. I simply didn't know what it was. The phone rang just as I was finishing up, and I answered with my attention still riveted to the page. "Hello? Miss Milhone?" Chapter 30. Kathy. Friday, July 3rd, 1953. Kathy stood behind the dining room door, forking cold Chef Boyardee ravioli from a can. The little pillows of dough were soft, and the tomato sauce clung to the surfaces like cream. Dinner wasn't coming up for half an hour, and Kathy was treating herself to a little snack beforehand. Kathy's mother had decided it was important to experience food from foreign countries, so the first Friday of every month she'd try a new recipe. This she called educating their palates. Last month she'd cooked this Chinese dish called sub-gum chicken chow mein that she served over English muffins with lots of soy sauce and crunchy brown noodle things on top. In May she'd cooked Italian spaghetti. And in April she made a French dish called beef bourguignon, which to Kathy's way of thinking was just like beef stew. Tonight they were having a Welsh dish that Kathy herself had prepared under her mother's watchful eye. First, she'd opened a package of Kraft Old England American cheese slices that she'd melted in a double boiler with a can of evaporated milk. Then she'd stirred in Worcestershire sauce and half a teaspoon of dry mustard, and that was that. Oh, yum! She could hardly wait. The ravioli was just in case there wasn't enough to go around. The problem was that ever since the gym teacher, Miss Carrico, made that remark about Kathy's losing 35 pounds, her mother had been keeping a close eye on her, serving her portion so small she left the table with a stomach ache. The first time it happened,
Kathy thought she'd done it by mistake. But when she'd asked for a second helping, her parents had exchanged a look that made her cheeks burn. It was like they'd been discussing her behind her back and secretly agreed with the teacher, which didn't seem fair. When Kathy first told her mother what Miss Carrico had said about how fat she was, her mother had been livid. She'd gone straight to the school principal to complain about the teacher's lack of tact and her sticking her nose to other people's business where it didn't belong. The principal must have turned around and given Miss Carrico a serious talking to, because now she made a point of ignoring Kathy, avoiding the sight of her altogether as though she didn't exist. Not that Kathy cared. If Miss Carrico tried to make trouble over her P.E. grade, she intended to tell her mother about the way she acted around Miss Powell, the home economics teacher. When Miss Carrico thought no one was looking, she got all weird and intense. It was almost like she had a crush on the other woman, which Kathy didn't think was right. She'd talked to her minister about it after one of the moral rearmament meetings, and he'd told her he'd look into it. But in the meantime, to keep information under her hat. Kathy wasn't sure how long she was supposed to wait before she took matters into her own hands. Actually, she thought it was possible Miss Carrico resented the Kramer family for their position in the community. On the 2nd of June, for instance, for Queen Elizabeth's coronation, the principal had especially asked if Kathy's dad would bring in their tabletop Ardmore television set so Kathy's class could watch the pageant all the way from England. He'd carried the TV into school and set it up right there in her 7th grade home room. All the kids had gathered around to watch the ceremony, and afterward, the principal made a point of personally thanking her in front of everyone. Miss Carrico had been standing in the back of the room with a smirk on her face, obviously not realizing Kathy could see straight through to that jealous heart of hers. By the same token, Kathy hoped the principal's praise and recognition hadn't made Liza feel bad. Liza might be prettier and get better grades, but that didn't make up for the fact that Kathy came from a better family. Her father was a well-known businessman, and her mother was often mentioned in the society section of the local paper. Kathy and her parents went to church together every Sunday, Kathy wearing her short white gloves and carrying the white leather Bible she'd been given at Easter. So what if she had to buy her clothes in the chubby department? Her mother said it was all baby fat, and she'd turn into a swan. Poor Liza's mother was divorced, and she drank all day long. Kathy didn't know how Liza could hold her head up, but Livia had explained that girls from broken homes deserved sympathy, not blame. She said Liza was doing the best she could under the circumstances. The important thing was not to lord it over her. Kathy could see her point. Not only did Kathy have nice clothes, but her mother had a new 2-door GE refrigerator with a separate freezer compartment. Also, the refrigerator came with a magic ice tray you twisted and the cubes popped right out. For Christmas, her father had given her mother a brand new wearing blender that Kathy used to make real milkshakes after school every day until her mother stopped buying ice cream. Livia said Kathy should count her blessings, which she most certainly did. She knew how lucky she was to have a real job working at her father's dealership, while Liza could only earn money babysitting and ironing Violet's clothes, which made her practically a servant. Kathy's mother wanted her to see the value of helping those who couldn't help themselves, an important lesson in life that Kathy'd taken to heart. She was the one who'd come up with the sewing project. Her plan was that she and Liza could make their entire school wardrobes using her mother's Singer sewing machine. Liza hadn't seemed that interested. She'd twice postponed their shopping trip to buy the pattern and fabric. She'd had a good excuse each time, but Kathy was still hurt. When she complained to her mother, Livia suggested Liza might be too embarrassed to admit she didn't have enough money to pay her share. Kathy understood completely. She'd even set aside $10 from her own weekly allowance to share with her friend. She'd appeared at Liza's door that morning, ready, finally, to make the trip into town, thinking how excited Liza would be when she realized Kathy was going to make her dreams come true. Kathy could just picture them in their matching outfits, not the same fabric or color, of course, because each of them needed to express her individuality, like it said in 17 magazine. But at school, come fall, seeing the similar style of their skirts and waistcoats, everyone would know they were the very best of friends. She'd been furious when she found out Liza was gone, but she decided to turn the other cheek. The principle of absolute love had taught her she could rise above petty disappointments. She'd even left a lovely birthday gift in Liza's room as a surprise for her friend. At the Five and Dime, she was so caught up in the notion of her own largesse, she bought two patterns, one for each of them. In part, this was to show that all was forgiven, and in part because she needed a much larger size. She bought 3 yards of pink wool for herself and a nice big remnant of gray corduroy for Liza. She was eager to share the news. But when Liza called to thank her for the bath powder, Kathy forgot her resolve. Disappointment had welled up, and she'd nearly burst into tears until Liza finally explained, poor, poor thing. She couldn't help it if her mother was weak. When Kathy heard her father's car pulling into the drive, she quickly hid the half-empty ravioli can behind the silverware canteen, then scampered into the living room and flung herself in a chair, her legs over one arm of it. The Howdy Doody show was on, and for all he knew, she'd been sitting in the same casual posture for half the afternoon. "Daddy, is that you?"
"Yes."
One word, and she could tell he was in a bad mood. She wasn't in such a hot mood herself after her fight with Liza on the phone. It was true what she'd said to her. She'd so been looking forward to their shopping trip. They used to go shopping or see a movie every Saturday afternoon, until Violet came along. Livia would drive them into Santa Maria and treat them to lunch at the soda fountain, after which she'd give them each a dollar and let them buy anything they wanted. Kathy could still picture the tuna melt and the BLT. Kathy had imagined the two of them walking arm in arm into adulthood, best friends, loyal and true, still thrilled to be together the same as they'd always been. It had taken her half the school year to realize something was wrong. At first, Liza was just busy. Kathy could understand that because when they finally got together, it felt like it always had. They'd giggle and eat popcorn, pour Dr. Pepper over ice and have burping contests. Gradually, she realized how distant Liza had become. She seemed cool, evasive, and Kathy couldn't think why. Her mother was the one who pointed it out. First, there'd been Violet, then Ty. Liza had her hands full, so it should come as no surprise she had little left to give. And now that she babysat all the time, what was Kathy supposed to do? After she'd delivered the birthday present to Liza's room, she'd spent a few minutes wandering around, touching Liza's things. Her hairbrush smelled exactly like her, and the teddy bear Kathy'd given her was still propped up against the pillows, which she thought was a good sign. She hadn't meant to snoop, but when she spotted the diary wedged in that dark, cobwebby space behind the bookcase, she'd sat on the bed and leafed through the pages in hopes of feeling connected. She knew it was a form of make-believe, but she loved the illusion of Liza sharing secrets, even though she hadn't actually confided anything for quite some time. She was also a tiny bit worried Liza was saying unkind things about her behind her back. It was possible Liza had an objection or complaint she was too scared to tell her to her face. Kathy thought perhaps if she could see herself from Liza's point of view, she could correct whatever it was that was making Liza pull away. On she read, somewhat discomfited, to realize she wasn't mentioned at all. The entries about Ty created a sharp pang. She suddenly understood that while she, Kathy, was focused on normal teen concerns, Liza was moving into womanhood. The details of Liza's relationship with Ty created a weird sensation of heat between Kathy's legs. At times, she'd felt something similar when reading True Confessions, and she'd known it was wrong. She'd done her best to steer Liza away from tawdriness and back to the safety of movie stars and movie magazines. She'd assumed she'd succeeded. so it was doubly shocking to realize that Liza was caught up in the same conflicts that filled trashy publications. How degrading for her. No wonder she couldn't bring herself to confide. Kathy could just imagine the stories. Too ashamed to tell my best friend. His love is leading me down the wrong path, but I can't stop myself. If only I had someone to turn to. One young woman struggled to stay pure. Instantly, Kathy knew she could be of help. As desperate as Liza was, she'd never be able to confess her plight. And, quite naturally, Kathy couldn't admit that she'd read the diary behind Liza's back. No wonder Liza was withdrawn. Given Kathy's high standards, Liza probably thought she'd be repulsive to her. How could she aspire to absolute purity when she was already compromised? Tampax had been the first step. The insertion of a tampon might even have unleashed slumbering impulses of the lowest sort. She had to find a way to let Liza know there was hope, that she hadn't strayed so far that there was no turning back. She was fully prepared to offer her friend whatever help she needed. It was just a matter of eliciting the information she wasn't supposed to have. While she waited for Liza's call, she rehearsed various ways of broaching the subject. It wasn't Liza's fault. Liza's father didn't even live in the same state. Liza scarcely saw him, and when she did, it was only like every 6 months. And Liza said they didn't really talk. In effect, she had no moral guidance whatever. So, what could you expect? In most of these scenarios, Liza would weep with gratitude, and Kathy would comfort her at length. Hours passed, and Kathy was seriously alarmed by the time her mother finally hollered up the stairs. "Kathy, Liza's on the phone." Kathy's stomach was knotted with dread. What if Liza had spent the whole day with Ty? What if he'd kissed her, and she'd found herself melting at his touch? Kathy had meant to convey her utter trustworthiness, but she'd forgotten about the bath powder, and Liza's thanking her for the gift had thrown her off. Next thing she knew, all her pain had poured out. She sensed how pathetic she was, but she longed for the familiar Liza instead of this alien person who'd been locked in the arms of a boy from the wrong side of the tracks. Liza hadn't even seemed contrite. She said she was sorry, but it didn't sound that way. Kathy had been so relieved when she realized the problem was Liza's mother. Sick and contagious? Well, no wonder. What did the woman expect at the rate she smoked cigarettes and drank? Kathy comforted her friend as best she could, but there wasn't any way to steer the subject around to you-know-what. Even so, by the time they hung up, everything seemed fine. She'd still have to find a way to worm the truth out of Liza, but at least things were back to normal. The problem was, she didn't feel happy, and she couldn't figure out why. That's what had driven her to the can of Chef Boyardee, not hunger so much as confusion and despair. Her mother called her for supper, and she was finally able to sit down at the table. She ignored her parents' little spat and focused on her plate. She'd been looking forward to the Welch rabbit, which was every bit as good as she'd hoped. Soft, warm cheese oozing across the golden brown raft of Wonder Bread. She'd put oleo on the toast, and the taste of melted margarine under the puddle of rich cheese was enough to make her weep. Her pain was receding, and she was almost feeling safe when her father made an offhand remark about Liza. Kathy could hardly pay attention. She was starving. She hadn't finished the can of ravioli, and she knew if her parents noticed how eagerly she was plowing through her food, they'd snatch it away from her and leave her desolate. She'd suffered losses enough. At first, the notion of Liza having lunch with Violet was absurd. Where'd he get that? She knew he said it to be mean, but he didn't usually make things up. Then she caught his mistake. "Very funny. Ha, ha. And where's Daisy all this time? Did you forget about her?"
"She was sitting right there with a big bowl of buttered noodles she was slurping through her lips."
That was the line that clinched it. Her father had never even been around Daisy. How could he know about her slurping her noodles unless he'd actually seen her do it? She'd protested, arguing the point, but only because she didn't want him to see he'd gotten the best of her. Her mother's feeble attempt to intervene only made it worse. By the time her father left the house, Kathy was taking the steps two at a time on her way to her room. She slammed the door and locked it. Weeping, she threw herself across her bed. This was the worst day of her life. She'd never felt so betrayed. Liza had lied about everything. On her very own birthday, she'd chosen to be with Violet Sullivan. They'd spent the whole entire day in a fancy restaurant, eating shrimp. All Kathy had ever wanted, ever, was to be with her friend. And now look what she'd done. She wasn't sure how long she'd been crying when she heard a little tap at her door and her mother calling her name. She knew her eyes were swollen to the size of ping-pong balls, and her nose was so snotty she wondered if she was coming down with a cold. "Go away!"
"Kathy, I brought you something. Do you mind if I come in?"
"Just leave me alone."
"I have a little treat for you."
"What?"
"Open the door and you'll see."
Reluctantly, Kathy blew her nose on a hanky and wiped her eyes with the hem of her T-shirt. She got up and unlocked the door. Her mother stood holding a glass of milk and a plate of brownies.
"I made these for my canasta club, but I have plenty. They're your favorite. Double chocolate with walnuts and pecans."
"I don't feel like eating."
"Not even one? You hardly ate your supper, so you must be a little hungry. Can I come in, just for a minute?"
"I guess." Kathy went back to her bed and sat down. Her mother put the glass of milk and the plate of brownies on the bed table. She could tell the brownies were still warm because she could smell the chocolate, as heady as perfume. She couldn't remember when her mother last offered her something to eat. Usually it was the other way around. Yet here they were, Kathy with her heart broken, her mother sitting on the other twin bed, her expression filled with concern.
"Are you feeling better?"
"No." Without looking at the plate, Kathy reached out and took a brownie and held it in her hand. Her mother said,
"I can see how upset you are."
"So?"
"I can understand why you're mad at Liza for lying, but is there anything else?"
"Like what?" She broke off a corner and put it on her tongue. She could feel tears sting her eyes.
"I don't know, sweetie. That's why I asked.
I get the impression there's more here than meets the eye. Is there anything you want to talk about?" Kathy couldn't figure out what her mother was getting at.
"Not really. Kathy Kins, I don't want us keeping secrets. That's not what a mother and daughter do when they want to feel close."
Her mother hadn't called her Kathy Kins since she started her menstrual periods a year and a half ago. Her mother had already bought supplies, a box of sanitary napkins and this strappy elastic belt thing you had to wear around your waist to hold the pad in place. Demonstrating how to stick the long, gauzy part of the pad in the fastener, she'd had the same worrisome look on her face, like maybe Kathy was suddenly vulnerable in ways she couldn't bear to explain. Her mother went on in that same loving tone.
"I know you're withholding something. Can you tell me what it is?"
"I'm not withholding anything." She broke the remainder of the brownie in two and put half in her mouth.
"You know I'll always love you, no matter what you've done."
Kathy looked up with astonishment.
"Mother, I didn't do anything. How can you think such a thing when I don't even know what you're talking about?" "Then what?"
"I want you to be absolutely honest. Whatever you tell me will never leave this room." Kathy was silent, staring at the floor. She didn't exactly have a secret, but she did have something that seriously concerned her. She knew her mother would have good advice, but she wasn't really sure she could trust her with this. "You'll tell Dad."
"No, I won't. As long as it doesn't have anything to do with your health or safety. Short of that, this is just between us." It's not about me.
Then who?
Liza?
Did she say something ugly about your weight?
No.
Two syllables.
Something ugly about her weight?
What ugly thing could her mother possibly have in mind? She was the one who talked about inner beauty.
But it has to do with her?
Sort of.
Has her mother's drinking gotten worse?
Kathy shook her head, avoiding her mother's gaze.
I'm just worried, that's all.
Oh, and why would that be?
Kathy had vowed to herself she'd never utter a word of it. Once she figured out how to get Liza to confess, she pictured the two of them in long, heartfelt conversations, sitting up half the night the way they'd done in the past. They'd roll their hair in bobby pins and smear Noxzema on their faces so they wouldn't get zits. Gently, she'd help Liza see the error of her ways and guide her to safer ground. Her mother studied her.
I don't understand what could possibly be going on with Liza that you're too ashamed to say.
Kathy felt she was under a certain amount of pressure here, torn between her loyalty to her best friend and her longing to throw herself into her mother's arms.
I promised I wouldn't tell.
Does this have anything to do with Liza touching herself?
Touching herself with what?
She saw something shift in her mother's face.
Oh, my Lord! Is she letting Ty Eddings have his way with her?
Kathy could feel a little mustache of perspiration forming on her lip.
Answer me.
Kathy murmured a reply, keeping it as vague as possible to keep from lying to her mom.
Speak up.
She let him touch her boobs and put his hand. She managed to mumble that last.
Where?
Down there. Livia looked at her, aghast.
She told you that?
Kathy shrugged one shoulder.
Are you absolutely sure?
Kathy said nothing, but she moved her mouth in a way that suggested she was sure.
After all, she'd read about it with her very own eyes.
Her mother's gaze was searching. You wouldn't lie about a thing like this to get back at her.
No.
How far have they gone?
Not very, just petting.
Petting?
Is that what you call petting, when he puts his hands on her privates? That's disgusting. Outside of her clothing or inside?
She hadn't expected her mother to probe for this kind of detail. The diary hadn't been specific, and Kathy didn't like having to commit herself.
Outside, inside, pick one.
Out.
How do you know?
Because she would have told me if he put his hand inside.
Well, thank heaven for small favors.
You wait right here. I'm going to take care of this.
What are you doing? Kathy wailed. You can't tell anyone. You promised.
Don't be ridiculous. Ty Eddings was sent here to shape up after the unfortunate situation he created in Bakersfield. If Dahlia York ever found out I knew about this and didn't go straight to her, she'd never speak to me again, and rightly so. I've entertained her in my own home, and I owe her that much.
But what if Liza finds out?
She's not going to find out, trust me. Your name won't come into it. Kathy listened with something close to horror as her mother went downstairs to the phone in the lower hall. Kathy hadn't meant to tell on Liza, but her mother just seemed to jump to the right conclusion before Kathy even said a word. She heard Livia give the operator Dahlia York's number, and then there was a silence while she waited to be connected. Kathy's stomach felt queasy, like she might have to go to the bathroom and do number two. The situation had gotten out of hand, but it wasn't her fault. She couldn't lie to her very own mother, could she? What kind of person would that make her? Besides which, if Liza had been honest to begin with, she never would have breathed a word of it, because that's what best friends do. Petting was wrong. The pastor said it created temptation, that kids might lose their self-control and go all the way. So, maybe it was just as well she'd spoken up when she did. She couldn't stand by and let something that horrible happen to her friend. It was like her mother said to Dahlia, her voice drifting up the stairwell. That boy is sure to take advantage if the situation isn't nipped in the bud.
Her mother's voice went on and on until Kathy tuned her out. Anyway, how would Liza ever know where Ty's aunt got the information? Chapter 31. My conversation with Ty Eddings was polite and to the point. I gave him a brief synopsis of the situation. The discovery of Violet's body buried in the Bel Air. The speculation about the hole and how long it would have taken to dig. I also repeated what Liza told me about the man she and Ty had seen at the Tanner property on Friday night. Do you remember anything about the make or model of the car? Liza thought it was dark-colored, but that's the extent of it. She says she was so scared she didn't really look. It wasn't a car. It was a late-model black Chevrolet pickup truck. It was? I'm amazed. How do you remember things like that? Because my dad had one like it. Only his was a 48. This one was newer. What about the guy? What did he look like? I don't remember him. Old. Like what? You were 17. 30s, 40s, something like that. In other words, he wasn't a kid. No one you recognized? I'd been in town for all of 3 months. I didn't know anyone to speak of except my high school classmates. Good point. I asked a couple of other questions, but he wasn't any help. I was moving into my wrap-up tone of voice, not wanting to waste his valuable lawyerly time, when he said, "How's Liza doing?" "Great. I'm so glad you asked. She's divorced. She bakes cakes for a living. She's just become a grandmother for the first time, but you'd never guess by looking at her because she's gorgeous. Too bad you didn't keep in touch." "Don't blame me. That was her decision. I wrote 6 or 7 times, but I never heard back. I assumed she wasn't interested." "That's not what she says. You disappeared the same weekend as Violet. She was devastated. Even now, she says you were the love of her life. A bad boy, but so adorable." Her words. "Are you matchmaking?" I laughed. "I don't know. Are you available?" "Actually, I am. My wife ran off with my secretary 18 months ago. Talk about a loss. The wife I don't miss. My secretary was the most efficient woman I ever met in my life. Liza's married name is Clements. She's in the phone book. If you remember anything else, I'd appreciate your giving me a call." "Will do," he said, and clicked off. I tried Liza's number. She was either out or screening her calls. So I left a message on her machine, asking her to get back to me. My purpose had nothing to do with her erstwhile boyfriend. She'd lied to me about Foley, and I wanted to know why. I glanced at my watch. It was 4:35, and at best I owed Daisy another hour and a half. It's not that I was punching a time clock, but I felt honor-bound. The problem was there was almost no point in confronting anyone else. Because who'd be dumb enough to volunteer the truth? You'd have to be a fool to admit anything when most claims couldn't be proved or refuted after 34 years. The best I could hope for was to encourage folks to rat each other out. Even then, the answers wouldn't be definitive. A clever killer would make it his business to implicate someone else. In any event, the problem wasn't mine to solve. The sheriff's department was handling the homicide, mustering all the authority, expertise, and technical advances at their disposal. All I needed to do, with Daisy's permission, was to pass along my report, which might or might not help. However, Ty Eddings had given me one small lead to pursue. If anyone was going to know who once owned a black Chevrolet pickup, it would be the man who sold them. I'd talked to Chet Kramer twice, and he'd struck me as a nice enough man. He knew his inventory and his customers, and he was passionate about both. What harm would it do to run the question by him? For the second time that afternoon, I picked up my jacket and shoulder bag and went out to my car. As I'd anticipated, Kramer was on the premises. In the interest of snagging business, the dealership stayed open until 9 o'clock every night. Chet told me that at the end of a hard day's work and a couple of stiff drinks, many a man found himself in the mood to look at new cars. What better reward for a job well done than to sit in a red-hot Corvette with a salesman fawning over you, demonstrating all the bells and whistles, offering to cut you a deal. You might pretend you were window shopping until you realized you could actually drive a new car home. Kramer was schmoozing with a married couple when I walked in. He was such an old hand at selling that I doubted they even realized what was happening. He had Winston fetch the keys, and he watched with something close to parental pride when Winston went off with them on a test drive. He caught sight of me and greeted me warmly, perhaps thinking I was finally in the mood to buy. I said, "I'm here to test your memory. I'm trying to find out who owned a black late-model Chevy pickup truck back in 1953. He smiled.
"Half the men in town," he said. "Let's go up to my office and I can check."
Glory be, you still have records from that era?
I have records dating back to 1925, the year I got into the business.
I climbed the stairs behind him and followed him to his office. He opened a door and led me into a storage area, easily as large as his office. File cabinets lined the walls on three sides, each drawer neatly labeled with dates and vehicle types. I said, "I don't believe this."
"Well, I'll tell you why I keep these. Every vehicle I sell represents a future sale. Customer comes in, I can talk about the cars he's owned and every servicing he's had. I can compare last year's models to this year's, compare this year's model to the one he was driving 6 years ago, good points and bad. He knows he can trust me because I have the facts at my fingertips, and I've taken the time to look them up before he walked in the door. Guy dies, I talk to his son, reminisce about the old man, and maybe sell him a car as well."
Without mentioning Ty by name or detailing the circumstances, I told him what I knew. Kramer regarded me with interest.
"So you're saying this fellow would have recognized the truck because his father had the 1948 model?"
"Right. And it couldn't have been later than 1953 because the 54 models wouldn't have come out as early as July."
"You're correct on that point. So a span of 5 years. That shouldn't be too hard. Have a seat and I'll pull what I have. There's a tin of chocolate chip cookies on my desk if you want to help yourself. My wife made them, Carolina. She's a fabulous cook."
The cookies were incredible, so I treated myself to another while I waited for him. 5 minutes later, he emerged from the room with an armload of files, saying,
"I keep these cross-referenced. Customer's name with the type of vehicle he's bought from me before. I don't go so far as to color code, but I can lay hands on the contract for every vehicle I've sold. What I have here is the Advanced Design Series, 1949 through 1953.
He handed me a scratch pad, pen, and two of the files while he took the other three. We sat and went through them, contract by contract, checking the color of the pickup, noting down the names of anyone who'd bought a black one. 25 minutes later, we each had a list, though mine wasn't at all enlightening. He got up and made copies of both lists and gave them to me. I ran my eye down the names on his list. "No one I recognize." He shrugged.
"The truck might have been repainted."
"In that case, we'd have no way to find the owner."
"Another possibility, the fella might have borrowed the truck. In those days, nobody locked their doors, and half the time people left their keys in the ignition."
"I've heard that before, and it actually makes sense. You go out to dig a grave, you don't want to use your own truck complete with California plates. Well, I'm sorry I wasted your time.
I guess every lead you get isn't going to pay off."
"Oh, that's for sure. Mind if I pick your brain about something else?"
"I'll help if I can. It's not like I have total recall of anything much beyond this dealership."
"Understood. I've been digging, and I've come up with something quirky. That being Harold Tanner's will." I went on to tell him what I'd discovered about the terms.
"I hadn't heard about that. Sounds like the old man had a mad on about something. Wonder what it was."
"I think Jake and Violet had a fling, and he found out." Some of the complacency faded from his eyes.
"I don't believe it."
"What, that they had a fling or that Tanner found out?"
"Violet and Jake? I can't imagine such a thing."
"Why not? Jake must have been handsome. I mean, he's not bad-looking now, and I can just imagine how he must have looked back then." His wife was dying of uterine cancer, so his sex life couldn't have amounted to much. If he ran into Violet at the moon, what with all the drinking that went down, it wouldn't be surprising if the two of them stumbled into a relationship. From what I've heard, she went after just about every man she saw. I was so intent on persuading him that I hadn't paid attention to his reaction. Now, I caught a glimpse of his face, and I flashed on the fact that he was married to a bloated Violet Sullivan clone. He had access to any number of pickup trucks, and I had no idea what he'd been doing with his time in the days before she died. How dumb could I get? Here I sat, about to lay out the evidence I'd gathered, when for all I knew, he was as capable of killing her as anyone else. "Go on," he said. I backpedaled. That's about it. I don't have any proof. I was hoping you might have heard a rumor to that effect. I did not, and it would grieve me to learn it was true. Mary Harrell was a lovely woman, and if Jake fooled around on her, he should be ashamed. Well, I trust you'll keep the notion to yourself. It's pure speculation on my part, and I wouldn't want him to suffer your ill opinion if he's innocent. He straightened up abruptly, dismissing me with a wave. I best get back to work. I've got things to do. Sure. Sorry to keep you. I appreciate your help. We shook hands across the desk. As I was leaving his office, I glanced back and noticed he hadn't moved. I went down the big staircase to the ground floor showroom. I wanted to have a conversation with Winston to see if he had any reason to believe there was a link between Violet and Jake. He was in his office, but so deeply engrossed in a telephone conversation, he didn't look up. I went out to the parking lot, where I unlocked my car and slid under the wheel. I was reaching for the ignition when the penny finally dropped. For days, I'd been convinced I was missing something obvious. But the more I tried to pin it down, the more elusive it became. Now, without warning, I finally got what it was. The dog. Daisy's car was in the drive when I arrived at the house. I'd returned the key to its hiding place beneath the flower pot. Rather than walk in unannounced, I rang the bell politely and waited on the porch until she opened the door. I took one look at her and knew something was wrong. She was still wearing her work clothes. The pallor in her complexion had shifted to the gray end of the spectrum, and her eyes were pinched with tension. I didn't think she'd been weeping, but she'd suffered a shock. "What is it?" She put a hand against her mouth and shook her head. Like a sleepwalker, she crossed to an upholstered chair and sank down on the edge. I closed the front door behind me. I moved to the sofa and sat down with my knees nearly touching hers. "Can you tell me what it is?" She nodded, but said nothing. I had to wait her out. Whatever it was, she'd been hit hard. A minute passed, and she sighed. Was her father dead? Another minute. When she finally spoke, her voice was so low I had to lean close to hear. "Detective Nichols was here. He left a few minutes ago, and when you rang the bell, I thought he'd come back." "Bad news?" She nodded and fell silent again. "They found 2 brown paper bags filled with my mother's clothes in the trunk. It's clear she was leaving us, or at least she believed she was."
"You must have guessed as much," I said.
"That's not it."
I put a hand on her arm. "Take your time. It's fine. I'm not going anywhere.
He said if there was any way to avoid telling me, he would. But he was worried word would leak out, and he didn't want me to hear it from anyone else."
I waited.
The text went over the car.
I waited.
She took a deep breath and exhaled with an audible sound. "When the pathologist peeled the curtain away from her body, they realized my mother's hands were bound behind her back. They think she was alive for some time. It looks like the dog was killed with a shovel they found in the bottom of the hole once they got the car out. It's possible the guy knocked her out and put her in the car, thinking she was dead. At some point, she must have come to and realized what was going on."
She stopped, fumbling in her pocket for a tissue. She blew her nose. Even tied up, she tried to claw her way free. Her fingernails were broken off, and some were caught in the upholstery fabric. There were tiny shards of glass embedded in the bones of her heels. She managed to kick out the window, but by then he must have started filling in the hole. She paused, struggling. All I could do was look on, allowing her to take whatever time she needed. The air felt heavy, and I could sense the weight of the darkness Violet must have known. Why scream for help when the silence would have been profound, thick yards of soil muffling any sound? The blackness would have been absolute. Daisy went on, addressing her remarks to the crumbled tissue.
I asked him what it would have been like for her, how she died. He said carbon dioxide poisoning. I forget some of it, the technical stuff. He said, basically, how deeply you breathe is regulated by your arterial oxygen pressure and carbon dioxide tension, some kind of pH that controls the reflexes in your lungs and chest wall. If there's not enough oxygen in the mix, your breathing picks up.